and welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between all of the different facets of our world that impact our health, well-being, and the well-being of our communities, our food, water, air, and earth, and the well-being of our society, which is not in really great shape right at the moment, as we can see, and how all of that impacts our habitat, the living system that supports our lives called planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk with different experts, advocates, thought leaders, journalists, authors, scientists, policy experts, filmmakers, and a host of other people, each of whom is focusing on a different aspect of all that is going on in what I call our total health environment. On today's show, I'm delighted to welcome back someone who's been a guest before and not too long ago. You know, you may remember him, and if not, you can go into the Connect the Dots archives and listen to that show later as well. He is Michael Nigro, an award-winning filmmaker, Emmy-nominated writer-director, and social justice activist based in Brooklyn, New York. His work as a photojournalist began during Occupy Wall Street, and later he was recognized with an Art and Activism Photography Prize by the Theo Westenberger Estates. Michael, in addition to, you know, a recent column on Truthdig and articles on the Huffington Post and elsewhere, is out covering the significant and crucial events of our time as a filmmaker and photographer, documentary filmmaker and a photographer. And we had him on the show before talking about his amazing experiences at the conclusion of Standing Rock and his deep perceptions of what was going on during that indigenous uprising, as well as the skewed media coverage of it. We talk media a lot with Michael. And he's back on today's Connect the Dots because he has recently returned from covering two of the signature events of this moment in time. The unfortunate, tragic, really, march outburst in Charlottesville of about 10 days ago, as well as this past weekend's Boston March. And so we're going to talk to Michael today both about what it's, you know, what he saw at these, really page-turning events for our epoch and crucial turning points for our future, and also what it's like to serve as a frontline journalist, as he has been consistently doing with tremendous clarity, creativity, and integrity. Welcome back to Connect with Dr. Michael Nigro.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be back. And you always give amazing introductions. So anytime I need, you know, a boost to my ego, I think I'm just going to call you up.
Feel free. Feel free. You have my number.
Sure.
You know, I just, you know, as somebody who has, I'm kind of a veteran journalist, and even though I sort of stand top of some, you know, of these events, and I also cover very specifically investigative pieces in my own niche, I am not out on the streets and, you know, at these things. And so the people who are, you know, journalists in their prime, who are up there in the, you know, the really most challenging of times that I have ever seen or known as an American citizen, doing that, have really a special place in my heart, because for, you know, without your work and the work of others who do what you do, we would really not necessarily know everything that's happening and have an important perspective on it. And it's absolutely crucial. We know that mainstream media, although they did cover this, I mean, this was something so, what happened in Charlottesville was so drastic, such a game changer, that, in fact, they did cover it. But, you know, many important things like Standing Rock, they're not there, or their coverage is very distanced, obscuring, or outright slanted away from, you know, what's actually going on. So can you, but you know, switching to what just happened, you know, what was it like for you to go down there? I mean, were you anticipating, were you covering this in anticipation of, you know, what were you anticipating, and what was it like to actually be there as the, you know, right on the street, on the ground as the events unfolded there?
Well, I've covered white nationalists and, you know, the alt-right type of rallies before. And with this age of Trump that I've witnessed and I've seen, whether it's at his, you know, the primaries, any of his rallies, it's always been escalated. And there's pockets that flare up, whether it's against the left, whether it's against journalists, whether it's against, you know, people of color, it just seemed to be getting hotter and hotter. And when I heard and I was assigned to go down to Charlottesville and began to see all the groups that were going to attend, I thought, wow, this really, the Trump administration and Trump himself has really unleashed the beast. And this is to say, and I write about this in Truthdig, that, you know, these seeds have always been there. It's been part of the landscape for in America forever. It's just that Trump has been watering these seeds for, you know, over 8 months now, and they're in full bloom. And Charlottesville was the alt-right, white supremacists, white nationalists in full bloom. So when I walked onto the scene and got there around 11:30, and I always travel with my helmet and my my flak jacket, and I was able to park, and I'm like, just as I always do when I hit the ground in a foreign city, I've done some homework as to, you know, where the streets go and where I'm going to be going and how I'm going to travel around and on foot. I walked over to the park, spoke to a state police officer. I said, you know, this is where Emancipation Park is this way. And he just looked at me, he goes, there's 5,000 angry people over there. And I'm like, okay. So I started walking, and there was projectiles, things being thrown. There was armed militia there. And I quickly turned around and got my flak jacket and my helmet. Went back in, and there's tear gas and mace being sprayed everywhere. And I was promptly hit in the head with a plank of wood, but I had my helmet on. And it took me a moment to realize what was happening in Emancipation Park. And Emancipation Park is the park that the alt-right, this was the, you know, the kind of inciting incident as to why the alt-right came to Emancipation Park, because they were going to be taking down a statue of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee. And they wanted to that statue there. That's what they said. That's why they came. So, inside that park, it was essentially a free-for-all. And I just kind of stepped back, because there were riot police there and there were police officers there, but they were just letting the alt-right attack the left, and then the left attack back and protect themselves and protect people who weren't there to fight. I've been covered protests for years now, and I've never, ever seen anything like this. It was as if the police force were NHL hockey referees, and they just let the two sides battle it out and beat the crap out of each other. And by battle it out, I mean, the alt-right came armed to the teeth. They came with baseball bats, metal poles, flag poles with spears on the end of them, AR-15s, Glock sidearms, brass knuckles, shields with nails and screws pointing outward as if they were part of, you know, they designed these like if they were in the Game of Thrones. So when they would charge into the left, that it would make a puncture wound. I mean, these are nasty, nasty battle devices. And the cops stood there. And I was in that for a while and witnessed, you know.
Let me just interrupt the flow of this for a second, Michael, just to ask a question.
Sure.
You know, I have two questions. First, what would the cops normally be doing in the past in such a situation, in your experience?
They would have never let those two sides get together. And you know, to be fair, whether you like it or not, you know, Virginia's an open carry state. So not like they were doing anything illegal. But when you have two sides like that, when one is coming armed to the teeth and the other one is going to defend themselves, that they did not try to keep them separate. One activist for Black Lives Matter by the name of Hawk Newsom, I think he's the president of Greater New York Black Lives Matter. I was standing right next to him, and I looked at him and just said, what is going on? He goes, the police are going to cause a riot. And I said, cause? I said, it's happening right before us. And he goes, yeah. And he was right. Like, they had it. And I've heard different reports, and I'm trying to do more research on it because I don't know if it's true, that the police had a stand-down order, that there's a couple of different thoughts, that they said they were outgunned by the alt-right, that there's too many weapons out there, that they didn't have enough weapons. The alt-right had more firepower. And also that they had a stand-down order to just let the two sides fight it out. I don't know if that's true, but given what I saw, I'm waiting for a police officer, someone to come forward and say that that is actually true. And I know there are people out there trying to dig to see if that is actually the case.
Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm like saying that they're outgunned means that they didn't know this was happening. They didn't understand the degree of arming and the potential of these people. They didn't come prepared, maybe, it's very likely, in fact, that, you know, I've seen too many, TV police dramas or anything, you know, where a SWAT team comes in and they're all, you know, in heavy suits and, they have overhead helicopters and, you know, they're sort of prepared to hone in on any situation in order to maintain control. And maybe, you know, this is just a naive, police crime drama view of reality. I confess that it probably is. But, you know, what you're describing sounds like they relinquished control through lack of preparation and lack of, you know, anticipation of what was going to go on here. And yet, for example, you know, at Standing Rock, we saw very heavily armed and protected military forces in all kinds of, you know, heavy-duty gear to protect themselves and armed in all kinds of ways. So, you know, I mean, it's either a conscious decision on someone's part, like you're trying to ascertain that, hey, we're not going to oppose this, or it's a woeful lack of preparation. Why weren't other forces brought in? You know, like, wasn't anyone infiltrated so they had a sense of where this might go? Are they unaware of the extent of the arming of these small but radical right-wing populations? I mean,
this is America. We all have guns coming out of our pores. I don't know how they could not have even thought that this was a possibility, but a probability. And I think this is complete continuity from Standing Rock, where you had a militarized police force and the National Guard protecting property. And you go to Charlottesville, what were they protecting? The statue. They were protecting property, not the people. And so that has to be called into question. Now, I had been having various conversations and people asking me, like, I can't believe nobody shot anybody. How could nobody have shot anybody? And like some lone person to shoot somebody. Well, yeah, I guess that's possible. But I think that speaks to the real seriousness of the alt-right. Like, they're not stupid. They don't want to go to jail. They want to see their agenda go forward. They want to see white supremacy prevail and eradicate everybody else. That, I mean, no one wants to go to jail, and no one wants to get caught. So as these flare-ups happened, yeah, do I think they wanted to kill people? Yeah, but they also don't want to get killed. They also don't want to go to jail and get caught. So it was, you know, you have this energy that is building, was the threat there? Oh, yeah. The threat was absolutely there. They had, you know, knives and guns, and it's possible it could have happened. Now, what happened a couple hours later was the car, and that's a whole nother scenario that I just wasn't expecting to happen.
Would it be too upsetting to describe that for listeners, you know, who might perhaps be unaware of what went on there? Shall I do it? Did you actually see it? And the reason I'm asking whether it would be upsetting is that, you know, that's a traumatic thing to see. I know that, you know, bear witness to. I know that our colleague, journalist and comedian Lee Camp was a direct eyewitness. And, you know, it's
right.
It's easy to be jaded when you're far away, or either when you don't tune into what's happening or when you're far away, you know, and you know, just reading about it in some distant way. So that's why I'm, you know, I'm asking that question. So I don't want to.
No, I it's taken some time, and I write about this in my Truth Dig piece, because I was the first person hit by the car. After everything kind of calmed down and the counter protest, there are a number of different footprints of the counter protest, and somehow, some way, they all just kind of met at the bottom of Market Street in Charlottesville. And so they had this whole group of people just coming together, and it turned into, you know, a standard march. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to take pictures of protesters and fists up in the air and signage. And it, you know, I kind of let my guard down in a way, because, you know, this is just a collective march, a collective protest.
Mm-hmm.
There is no sign of any of the alt-right. I had no idea where they went. I didn't have any contacts with anybody who was monitoring that. So when I got to the front of this march, the protesters had said they didn't know where they were going. And somebody said, let's just go left. Let's go up this hill. So I ran to the top of this hill so I could get a shot downward, just to get a scope of how many people were there. And I thought it was a beautiful shot. So I'm setting up my camera, and I wear these harnesses. And one camera is dangling off my left hip, and I have another camera in my hand. And I heard a screech of tires behind me. And for whatever reason, some instinct just told me a screech of tires moved to the sidewalk. And I took one step, a small step to my right, and my camera that was on my hip was just crushed by the front end of the car. And it just smashed into the camera, and it spun me around. You know, my first reaction was, what a jerk. Like, what are you doing? It didn't dawn on me that somebody was going to be plowing into the crowd down below. But I rendered that in my head, because I saw bodies flying up and around, and started shooting as fast as I could. That's what happened to me. I will say that without the two cars that were down at the base of the hill, and they weren't part of the protest at all. They were just people that trying to get through the city, and I don't know where they were going. They weren't part of the protest, but they got stopped by the protest. So they just sat there, and they were actually taking people inside those cars, were taking pictures of, you know, the protesters. But if those cars weren't there, more people would have been hurt, because the man who was driving the car was going to go and just plow through everybody that was down below. He instead smashed into the back of the car. He threw it in reverse and began to run over people backwards. And I started to run and jumped between these two buildings. And then at that point, I was able to get my live stream up and try to maintain some kind of calm. And people respond differently in these types of situations. And I started to film and shoot. I have a little bit of training for medical, but the street medics the street medics are people who are part of the protest. They sign up and they donate their time. They were right on the injured. They started making sure people, hoping they were all right, they started performing CPR on Heather Heyer, and attending to wounds, which I saw, you know, broken bones and head wounds and just a lot of blood, and just tried to cover it as best as I could.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. I mean, that is, this is just, you know, like on city streets, right? And there it is happening. Has that individual been apprehended?
The driver of the car, yes. They, it's very strange. Again, I cover these things, and it's very strange to me that that car knew where the march was heading. And because the police force that was not letting anybody, any cars or any people down certain roads, this was one of them. And I, the reason why I mentioned before, when I was at the front of the march didn't know where it was going. So when they decided to go left and they started, you know, yelling to the back, like, let's go left, let's go left, that's when I ran to the top. And somehow, some way, that car knew the direct street to go down. I don't think it was a coincidence that this car was able to sneak through. It just doesn't add up to me. Is it possible that he was just there and he had this instinct just to go mow people down? I don't know. But it was a complete act of terrorism. And I've heard this phrase before. This is not an original. You know, he may have driven the car, but Trump gave him the keys.
Mm-hmm. And this young woman died as a result, sadly.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Were the counter-protesters themselves armed?
What I can say to this is that when I walked in, I saw some of the counter-protesters and Antifa that had taken away some of the bats and some of the planks of wood from the alt-right. I don't doubt if that they did not come armed. I think there are, but it was such a small contingent of Black Bloc / Antifa that were there. And this is a larger discussion. I have certain feelings on the Black Bloc and Antifa, but because without them, this small contingent of people, there would have been far, far more people hurt. They stood up to and they protected many people that were just there to be, just to have their voices heard and stand up to this racism that we're not going to engage. And as Cornel West and a number of other clergy that were there that day, Cornel West came out and just said, look, the anarchists and Black Bloc and Antifa, like, he goes, they saved our lives. And he's not kidding. They, Cornell, I think his quote on Democracy Now! Was, they would have crushed us like cockroaches. And they, it's not theoretical when you watch this happen before your eyes. They were there to hurt people and hurt them badly because, and so you put the two against each other. You know, that you have the alt-right. They live in a binary world. It's an us versus them. They don't want the other side. They want the other side completely eradicated. Their wanted conclusion is that their end game is that a singular white world. That is it. With Antifa and the Black Bloc, they are protecting all races, all creeds, all colors. And they want an egalitarian world. So they are fighting against, you know, this eradication. And I think, you know, it's opened my eyes as to, are we at this point where we need to actually stand up to violence with violence? I struggle with this because I I saw what violence did to in Occupy, during Occupy Wall Street, and it turns off people trying to make a mass movement. Once violence happens, the soccer moms and dads who bring kids and strollers to protest, they tune out. But I think right now you're looking at this white extremism and the white supremacy house, the White House, what they've unleashed, and that is they are they walk around and they're cocky, and then they feel empowered and emboldened to carry out their agenda, which they're saying thank you to Trump. I mean, David Duke came out the next day after Trump gave some pathetic statement and thanked Donald Trump. Charlottesville was a victory for the alt-right, 100% complete victory. And I think people need to know that. And that's why I went back to Boston the next weekend.
What was happening in Boston for our listeners who may not be aware of that gathering?
Sure.
What you covered in Boston.
Before Charlottesville happened, that whole weekend, there was a number of alt-right protests that were going to happen at Google for various reasons in various cities. They were going to, all the alt-right was going to march on Google. Charlottesville happened. They canceled them all, except in Boston, where there was going to be a quote-unquote free speech rally right in the common in downtown Boston. They decided not to cancel it. The response from the Boston community and greater Boston area, and really just, you know, people from the East Coast, was no, we are going to stand up. This was a direct response to what had happened in Charlottesville. So you go down to Boston, and you have a footprint of where this alt-right free speech rally is going to happen, and it is all caged off by the Boston police, and they are only letting people in who can prove or know somebody that is on a list. They get patted down, they go get their bags rifled through. I saw about 40 people walk through this gate, as opposed to 40,000 that came to shout down and quash this movement, this white nationalist free speech rally. And it was empowering. I mean, it shut that down. And to have 40,000 people march strong in Boston, which has had their problems. There are some people that say it is the most racially divided city in America. I think they showed a lot of muscle this past weekend. And for me to go there was more of a I figured that it was going to be better managed, and that I think the reaction from the left and was as I was reading about it, I'm like, you know, I don't think we're going to have another Charlottesville, but you never know. Like, when can a car come through? Will somebody shoot somebody? Will somebody explode something? I mean, that's where we're at right now. That's where we're there's not a whole lot of discussions happening. And also I'll say this, and this goes back to my conundrum with Black Bloc and the anarchists and Antifa, you know, and they walked into the counter protest and got cheers. People were cheering them because maybe we are at that point where we need to stand up to it with being physical. I'm still thinking about that, so.
That's that is a shocking development. Can you just tell our listeners who these organizations, Antifa, Black Bloc, who they are, for people who would need to understand this debate, and what are those organizations, what are they saying, and of course as you describe that, many, I would say, the majority of any kind of moderate or liberal leaning people are going to be upset or turned off or want to, you know, automatically reject any use of violence. I mean, the models for our movements are really, you know, the nonviolent peace movement, Gandhi, all of the above. And, you know, what we saw at Standing Rock, of course, and I'm not, you know, condoning or you know, we're having an open question about this. But, you know, what we saw at Standing Rock were people in prayer and peaceful protest, you know, being beset by military force. You know, many people were injured. Amazing, more people, you know, weren't killed at that point. And I've often heard people from the ongoing water protector movement, and this is by no means every single individual that leads or that's in the movement, but there is a kind of sense that in modeling peaceful protest as the indigenous communities and their allies did at Standing Rock, you know, they basically put the fear in the corporations and, you know, kind of, and in some way, while vulnerable and human, their courage created a sense of a greater protection or invulnerability. And, you know, I, on the one hand, would love to believe that was true. And on the other, I'm skeptical of it because, you know, that can turn on a dime, you know, as all of this progresses. And, you know, so, you know, all it takes is, you know, further aggressive action, and then, you know, people are further harmed. And, you know, people who, I mean, people who are ready to take that risk, have nothing to lose, are deeply embittered, or, you know, for a variety of reasons, can, you know, kill, can inflame a situation, and can, you know, increase and the divisions in this country to, you know, a level where democracy is really highly at risk, if not over. I mean, we already know we live in oligarchy, but so tempered by all of that, you know, that's my consideration. I don't believe that we're invulnerable, although the more of our numbers there are, the more people who pay attention and join, the more people who are, you know, ready to defend and protect and participate, the better. Obviously, because there is greater protection in numbers. And so incidents like this also, you know, it's very heartening that 40,000 people came to Boston. That's 40,000 people who are saying we're not going to be intimidated by this. Other people, you know, are intimidated by it. And, you know, at the mention of any violence, they're, you know, they further feel that it even violates their belief system, their code of action and integrity, et cetera. So, you know, with that framing, though, you're saying that these groups have really saved lives of people who were peacefully protesting. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who they are?
Well, I know there's other people who can speak more eloquently on this. This is what I know. Black Bloc and Antifa, it's not an organization. It's not like you pay dues and you are a card-carrying member. Like, it's a tactic. And the tactic being, you know, for Black Bloc, for instance, they are about this kind of petty vandalism against corporate power. They want to stop corporations and capitalism. So smashing a window of Bank of America or Starbucks, is that better than these capitalists that are destroying people's lives and hurting people, putting profits over people? So there's that dichotomy. So they're going to smash up an ATM to throw a wrench into capitalism. And this is what you saw at the inauguration. But also what they do is there are protesters out there. There are grandmothers that are walking and holding an anti-Trump sign or an environmental sign. And if the police attack them, they will come in and they will protect that person. And I watch it happen. In Charlottesville, as I mentioned before, there were clergy, there were families, there were people who might tout themselves as peaceful protesters in the style of Gandhi and King. But the other, the right, doesn't care. You know, they want to hurt those people. You're Jewish, you're a person of color, you're gay, you're indigenous, you're undocumented. They're going after you, and they want you hurt. They want you, they want to eradicate you. And so there's your conundrum. So are you going to stand there and perhaps have your life taken from you because there's a puncture wound that they run into, or they hit you with a club, or beat you like they did DeAndre Harris in Charlottesville? I mean, I watched DeAndre Harris get run into a parking garage and beaten with bats and brass knuckles and what looked like this towel wrapped, like something heavy wrapped in a towel, and just get his skull crushed. And if it wasn't for people that came in and rushed in, and they saved his life without question. And so with Antifa, it's anybody who's fighting anti-fascists, who's fighting fascism. And again, it's not an organization. It's a tactic. Like, you could be Antifa. You could be Black Bloc. I've been in those situations where I'm following it. And as a journalist, I shouldn't have been wearing all black, but I was. But, you know, that's – anybody can join. My daughter could join. And it's the tactic. Some people have talked about Occupy being a tactic, where you occupy space, that it's not really a movement anymore. It's more of a tactic. And and that's really my question, is what I'm wrestling with. It's probably going to be the next piece I write, is, you know, where are we as a country, and should we be applauding what happened in Charlottesville? Because the anarchists, without question, saved people's lives.
Wow. Yeah, no, I hear you. That's scary. You know, that's the time and that's where we are. I mean, that's really an incredibly frightening thing. Let me ask you what it's like for you, you know, among the many people who, you know, are seeing this from different distances and vantage points, you know, or not at all. You know, what is it, you know, one of the things that often happens to me is people say to me, you know, because I'm a privileged white person, people often say to me things like, I don't know why you're choosing to do this. You don't have to, you know, get involved with this. You know, like, why are you putting yourself through this? By reporting, by bearing witness, by sharing information, by doing all of this, you know, like, the implication is we have a choice and we don't have to, right? And, you know, my view is that the protection of the people who are trying to protect others, protect our country, protect the planet, is to stand together with people who all want that rather than hang back and opt out of it, you know, and that's just, so, and I've been, you know, and so I just reflexively, you know, keep doing that. That's my commitment, you know, and I've been doing it for a while. But a lot of people are, you know, it's kind of optional. You know, but it's a further, you know, and people are like, you know, like, look to political leaders, you know, to lead the pack about this. And, you know, in some cases there are some that are terrific, like Bernie Sanders, and then there are others who are equivocating, and their role or efficacy is actually very undermined by that equivocation. And I very often see my fellow journalists as being on the front line because of reporting on and showing us what's happening, giving us that opportunity, and yet it also takes a big toll to do that. And, you know, I wonder if you can, you know, I mean, it really broke my heart to see Lee Camp sharing. And, you know, he is obviously recovering. He's probably getting help for it. you know, since then, but to see him just after in the state of shock and confusion, you know, very often people will say, well, oh, I'm not surprised this went down, and I'm not surprised when that went down. You know, and that's mental surprise by information. It's very different from the shock of a direct perception of this kind of harm and violence as it goes on, as the police stand back. You know, what is the effect on journalists like you, and how do you deal with it?
Well, I thought Standing Rock was bad. And I've been on front lines with police where I've seen beatings and unnecessary use of fists and pepper spray and batons. Standing Rock was a little different, where you'd have a militarized police force, and I'd looked up and I have somebody with a sniper rifle pointing right at me. That does wear you down mentally. The images don't go away, and people talk about PTSD. It's very real. And what happened to me after, essentially almost being killed. There's moments where I just don't know why I'm sitting on this, sitting in a chair talking to you. And it comes out of nowhere. It's unpredictable what triggers these kind of thoughts and images. So there are strategies and tactics, and seeking help is great, and talking about it is really healthy. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to come on and share this with you. It's one of the reasons why the day after this happened, I drove 5 hours back to my home and wrote the piece for Truth Dig. And I spent hours on my photographs that I took that day and got my live stream out that, you know, I look at it and it's, you know, it's up to over 100,000 people viewed this. And to me that it helps me in a way to know that people are engaging. And but you know, the being on the front line, it's tough. It is tough. And it was very important for me to go to Boston just to go back out and say, you know, no, I'm not going to stand down. I'm not going to let that group get the best of me. And it was important for me, for the 100,000 people that watch my live stream, to know that, no, I'm not going to sit down, because you cannot deny that this hate and how it affects people. It affects your neighbor, your acquaintance, your friends, your families. I mean, at best, what, you're just going to hope it's going to go away? Or worse, that just you pretend it doesn't exist? It exists, and it's in the White House, and it's growing. And which is why I do seek help to talk to people about, you know, what happened to me that day. And I do have a great support system. And even you being one of them, you reaching out to me to talk about this, it's super important. And it's going to be something I carry with me for the rest of my life, because, you know, my life was almost catastrophically changed that day.
Mm-hmm. What is your, you've said it many times, but, you know, being on the forefront and, you know, being in the reality that people are seeing, you know, at various degrees of distance, you know, of a turnkey fork in the road moment for our country, you know, gives you some, you know, we all have intuitions or senses of things, and, you know, sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. You know, so it's not like any kind of ironclad prediction. But, you know, what is your concern? What is your sense of where we are, where, what our choices are, and where, you know, where this could be going, and what would be best to, you know, ordinary people to do to intervene?
I've had this conversation this past week, like, what are the next steps? And, you know, there were marches to Trump Tower here in New York. And, you know, people getting out doing that might be played out. Because how many more times can people do that and then be, you know, marshaled so they don't even reach Trump Tower? I mentioned this issue before. I mean, that people are getting out for the first time and marching and holding up a sign and giving the middle finger to Trump Tower. I think that's played out at this point. So what is the next step? I had one friend say to me, she says, no, we need to make Washington afraid, because they're not afraid. And because they're supposed to be working for us. And they are not. So is this a march on Washington? Is this a takeover of the state house? Like, where is this taking us? And this also leads directly back into it. I'm sorry I keep going into this, but just having witnessed, you know, what the anarchists and the Black Bloc and Antifa did in Charlottesville, it's strange for me to say this. Is it a necessary action now? Is this where we are? Is this where we brought ourselves? And there were people that day that took, you know, baseball bats to the head, that were charged at with Game of Thrones types of, you know, devices. So you sitting at home on your couch didn't have to. When is the point going to be that you're going to get up from that couch? And because other people are doing this, because, again, they are empowered. And it was a victory for them. I don't even know if I answered your question.
No, I think you posed the question back to people who are, you know, sidelined as civilians in what sadly is becoming a kind of war in terms of questioning, you know, who is fighting this war, who's on our side in this war, who is pressing the issue in the way that we feel it needs to be pressed and where we'd like to see it go, or are we involved, are we neutral, you know, are we just kind of marking time here on planet Earth until it's all, you know, we're out of here and then leaving the problem to the next generations? I mean, you know, like, what are we actually up to, and, you know, what are we doing, and where is our moral and ethical calibration, you know, on all of that? Or, you know, are there ways to support the fighters? I mean, you know, because, you know, on the alt-right, I mean, is basically a renegade manifestation of cultural malaise that has, you know, and cultural and economic loss and outrage that has been cultivated, but they are not, you know, and our laws have permitted them to arm themselves. But, you know, the real behind-the-scenes players are those who are controlling the political system, the economic system, and the legal and policy system, and allowing this to go on. And, you know, because of climate and because of democracy, we're kind of really running out of time. And so that's what I
right.
You know, hear embedded in you know, what you just said. I mean, it's the old, which side are you on, you know? And is it enough to just be sentimentally on one side, you know, or, you know, how do you, you know, really support that side so that it's not a side of martyrdom, you know, which is what's being kind of acted out. Now, I hear a lot of people, and I know this isn't your area of expertise, but I hear, you know, any day now they've got Trump, he's going to be impeached, he's going to step down, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. So we're sort of waiting, you know, for this investigator group to solve this problem. And, of course, removing one figurehead tyrant from a systemic problem is not a total solution. But I mean, I just have to ask you because I hear this from people all the time. You know, well, now he's finished, da 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 da, and yet somehow we haven't seen him finished yet. Are we relying? You know, what do you think? I mean, are we hoping for somebody else to fix our problem? I mean, where is the solution going to come from?
If Trump gets he gets impeached, who's next in line?
Mm-hmm.
Mike Pence.
Mm-hmm.
An evangelical
mm-hmm.
Christian terrorist. I mean, so, and somebody who, frankly, let's say Trump goes away. The Republicans
mm-hmm.
are so good at spinning this. I think it will solidify the Republican base. Meaning like, okay, now we're getting back to real Republican values with Mike Pence. Hooray. Like, could that solidify? I mean, if there is splintering of the Republicans, which I'm sure there are, I'm glad some people are speaking out. I'm glad some people who voted for Trump are saying this is a huge mistake. And
mm-hmm.
but it's not enough. There's other people that just like he can do nothing wrong, and it's
mm-hmm.
you know, call it insane, but that's his base. And you know, I need to say something of what you talked about with this. The white supremacist, white nationalist group. These guys are well organized, and they're well funded,
mm-hmm.
and many of them are former military. The language in which they
mm-hmm.
speak, the way they form their lines. There's also this odd element, and this is my spin on it: of these guys are gamers. They look at this as a game, and driving a car and just running over people has very little consequence, and running into people and beating the crap out of them with these batons that they did because they were sitting on their couch. Like, there is this game. I mean, think about drone operators. It's a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
this is kind of this mentality that I was kind of piecing together watching. I've had few conversations with these with white nationalists, but that's the feeling I get. So you know, sitting on the sidelines, there are other things you can do. You know, you can be a keyboard warrior. You can learn. You can help people with jail support. You can there's different avenues that you go become get some medical training, you know, at some of these protests. You can become a liaison to the police. You can be, you know, there are so many different avenues. You can help fund things, and you have to face it. There's a great quote by James Baldwin, and I hope I don't botch this, but it's not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. So you know, I mean, that's the life of an activist. You know, you get one victory and then you get chopped down a little bit. So you move forward again and then you get chopped back again. It's this continual, you have to keep moving forward and facing these things down. But to bury your head and pretend it doesn't exist until it affects you, I mean, that's why I do what I do. So you don't. So I'm hoping my kids don't have to do this, but they're at an age now where they understand, and they want to be involved. So, I think that's where we are: is figure out your role and really take action and listen to the people that have been oppressed. Listen to the people that have been victims of white supremacy. I had a crazy email from a friend that just was kind of bashing my photographs and said, yeah, where are the pictures of the anarchists beating up, you know, the other side? And I said, you're actually choosing that side. And those are tough conversations to have, because I just think his white privilege was showing that, you know, he believes that everything he did, it was because he did hard work that had nothing to do because he was white, and that didn't help him economically. And I think people mm-hmm. need to realize that, you know, if you think that what you benefit from now economically had nothing to do with white privilege, I mean, think about it. just keep your head buried in the sand.
Yeah. I mean, I've also heard people kind of saying, well, we have to look on all sides. I mean, there are people in this sort of psychology or spiritual realm where, you know, like we have to, all people are people, all people are human. We have to look on all sides. They can say this even as the president, you know, made that same inaccurate point equating the sides. And, you know, what you've described among, you know, in your description of who the alt-right folks are, you know, your perception that they're gamers, I think, you know, actually forms a basis for refuting that, because actually that's a, you know, we have people who have had so much trauma and seen so much harm and death and participated in it in a way that is beyond processing, that they are, that they're what we regard as normal human emotions, you know, spirit or soul participation or anything else, is basically kind of hammered out of them, and they are completely hardened and dissociated. And, you know, so, you know, while we're being sensitive, they're in a completely different condition. It's extremely hard for people to imagine what it would even be like. And then they're, you know, they've been unleashed. So, you know, that unleashed in, you know, by the powerful forces behind the scene, the corporations and all the folks that I write about all the time in terms of what they're up to in our world. But, you know, they've been unleashed because it's a great distraction and way for those corporations to continue in control to have these kinds of events happening. You know, you know, it's a great thing for them, and I think we also have to see it in that larger context. Well, we're coming here to the end of our time on Connect the Dots. This has just been an amazing conversation. So grateful to Michael Nigro, who you're, you know, coming on the show today to talk with me and you know, our listeners. And, you know, share your frontline experiences and, you know, the kind of painful reality of, you know, what's been going on these last weeks. I also feel that, you know, grieving and solidarity are really essential at a time like this. That's the only way through to face up to what's going on and take constructive action. And I think through our conversation, you know, and through all of your terrific reporting on Truthdig and, you know, on your website and everywhere where you share your extraordinary work, that you're really helping people to do that and playing a very important role. So I want to thank you for all your work. And thank you again for coming on to Connect the Dots and for whatever you're going to be doing next, which I'm sure is going to be an important contribution.
I really appreciate all your work that you do, too. Thanks so much. And if anybody wants to follow me on Instagram or Twitter, I'm at NigroTime, NigroTime. Thanks so much, Allison.
Thank you, and thank you, listeners, for being with us on this week's Connect the Dots. Please share this show with others in iTunes and repost on your websites. Follow Michael at NigroTime, and, you know, share the show from the Connect the Dots archives, which will be up shortly. And thank you for being with us today, and look forward to the next edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back again Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. On the Progressive Radio Network, I'm Allison Rosevi.